Some of these are going to be human spirits. Some of them are going to be interdimensional beings, sure. Some of these are going to be time slips where we're getting a glimpse of another moment in time. So they're neither a human spirit that is stuck there. They're not an interdimensional being either. We are actually seeing another moment in time play out. Some of these are also extraterrestrials.
This is your nautical lantern on the dangerous seas of darkness. Let's push off from the placid shore of the status quo and explore what's beyond the horizon. I am your host, BT, and this is Truth and Shadow, your podcast of the supernatural.
In the vast expanse of human knowledge lies a realm largely uncharted, a domain where the ordinary meets the extraordinary, where mysteries lurk in the shadows of everyday existence. It's a space that beckons the curious, the seekers, and those willing to entertain the notion that our understanding of reality might be just the tip of the iceberg. For someone like me, this is where the journey truly begins. To embark on this odyssey, skepticism becomes a weight to be cast aside. What if, instead of dismissing the unexplained as a mere fantasy, we dare to entertain the possibility that there is more to our world than meets the eye? As I navigate these mysteries, I find myself drawn to the heart of paranormal research. It's not merely about chasing ghosts or seeking extraterrestrial life. It's an intricate exploration into the unknown, a journey that challenges the very essence of what we think we know. From the eerie glow of unidentified lights in the night sky to the palpable energy in alleged haunted locations. Paranormal research encompasses a spectrum of experiences that defy easy explanation. The true value in this pursuit lies in its potential to push the boundaries of scientific knowledge. While conventional scientific disciplines adhere to well-defined frameworks, paranormal phenomena exists on the fringe of understanding. It's in these uncharted territories that new theories may emerge, expanding the very paradigms that govern our scientific worldview. Consider the realm of parapsychology, where psychic abilities and telepathy beckon exploration. Critics label it pseudoscience, but proponents argue that here, on the fringe, lie untold facets of human consciousness and perception. By challenging the status quo, paranormal research beckons scientists to question assumptions and explore uncharted avenues of inquiry. Beyond the scientific realm, the pursuit of the paranormal becomes a catalyst for wonder and curiosity. In a world dominated by routine and the mundane, this journey invites us to embrace the mystery that envelops us. It challenges us to question preconceptions and consider the possibility that reality, as perceived, is but a fraction of a more intricate puzzle. For some, these experiences transcend the physical, providing a connection to something greater. Exploring these phenomena offer insights into the human psyche, cultural beliefs, and how individuals make sense of the mysterious. From a psychological perspective, paranormal research becomes a portal into the intricacies of the human mind. The cultural impact of this pursuit is equally profound. Throughout history, from ancient myths to contemporary popular culture, the fascination with the unknown has been omnipresent. Characters embodying the archetype of the fearless explorer become cultural icons, sparking public interest in the broader field of paranormal research. This cultural fascination serves as a gateway for individuals to engage with the mysteries of the world, inspiring a new generation of scientists and researchers. Undoubtedly, paranormal research is not without its challenges and controversies. Many decry it as pseudoscience, subjective interpretations, and a lack of rigorous methodology. Yet these very challenges underscore the need for a disciplined approach, demanding rigorous research methodologies, adherence to ethical standards, and collaboration between scientists and skeptics. To elevate paranormal research to scientific credibility, embracing a multidisciplinary approach becomes the imperative. Insights from physics, psychology, and other scientific disciplines must converge to unravel the mysteries with a level of rigor that commands respect within the scientific community. In conclusion, the value of paranormal research transcends the pursuit of ghosts or extraterrestrial entities. It is a journey into the uncharted territories of the human experience, pushing the boundaries of scientific understanding and challenging preconceptions about reality. Through my eye, as one who dares to explore the unknown, the pursuit of the paranormal is not just about seeking answers. It's about embracing the mysteries that make our world infinitely complex and intriguing. Whether approached with skepticism or open-minded curiosity, paranormal research invites us to consider that indeed the truth is out there and it's waiting to be uncovered.
A peculiar phenomenon exists in the hushed corridors of time, where the past and the future coalesce in an intricate dance. Enter a domain where shadows disguise themselves in the cloak of the unseen, lingering silently on the outskirts of perception. Within the ordinary fabric of existence, time is a steady stream, ticking ever forward second by second. A mere step, a fleeting moment, and the boundaries between yesterday, today, and tomorrow blur. To sort these mysteries is our guest. He is a researcher of the hidden, haunted, and hallowed, author of The Ghost Story and Case Files, A Walk in the Shadows, and his most recent book, Travels Through Time. He is the host of Connecting the Universe and Mike's Morning Mug. He is on a journey where the hands of the clock hesitate, and the line between the present and the echoes of history is drawn in the shades of uncertainty. His footsteps echo in the shadow dimension, and his voice calls out through the void. Mike Ricksecker, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, Brandon. I really enjoyed that intro. Thank you.
We've been talking about angels. We've been talking about demons and the demonic and how they both play into our lives, whether we're religious or not. But either way, the supernatural seems to be a part of the furniture of our daily existence. And I thought we could talk about some haunted objects for a little while, because it seems that even the other place, the unseen, seems to interact with things that we can touch.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, that certainly happens. Haunted objects are a fascinating topic. You know, how is spirit energy attached to one specific object and travels with it? You might have an object from... that might be from somewhere across the globe, and you bring it home with you from wherever it came from, and all of a sudden strange activity starts to occur. So yeah, definitely a fascinating topic.
Some of us who grew up, I guess the younger kids really grew up with Harry Potter, and so they're well aware of things like Horcruxes, and that's kind of their introduction to objects that have an infusement of some kind of energy. What was the most interesting object that you researched?
Oh, that's a that's a interesting question. So I've dealt with a variety of things over the years, but one that I've always found fascinating that I've not actually gone to see myself, but I'm quite familiar with the history and a number of the stories and different people that I've networked with that have done more investigative work on the object is Robert the Doll down in Florida, because this is the story behind it is essentially that Gene Otto, who is the child associated with this, this became like his it's a stuffed toy and became like his best friend. But the toy itself started, you know, moving around the house, doing strange things and what have you. And even after he became an adult and was reunited with the toy itself, again, strange things happened and were associated with this particular doll. And after Gene passed away, the doll is now in a museum, and there's this whole legend around, you know, don't take any photos of it or bad luck is going to happen to you, and that sort of thing. But, you know, looking at the case itself, and this is, you know, on the outside looking in, I think it was really a very, very specified poltergeist activity type of a case. And what I mean, I don't mean, you mentioned Harry Potter, I don't mean like Peeves, the poltergeist from Harry Potter, which is your classic noisy ghost. Yeah, this is more of, you know, there is poltergeist type activity happening within the household, and usually it's because you have somebody in the house that is exhibiting PK activity or telekinesis, and even unbeknownst to them, and they're, you know, that's acting out, it's manifesting itself throughout the house. So it appears as ghost type activity, but it's actually associated with that person. So you might have objects being thrown around and what have you. But and I think this was the case with Gene, but it was very, very specific to Robert the doll itself, and that all of his PK manifestations, rather than just being outwardly at anything around the house, occurred in Robert. And so, you know, anytime that Robert was moving around the house or seemingly up to something nefarious, that, you know, it was really the energy from Gene. And even into his adulthood, the same thing. He still had that connection to this object. Now, the whole legend of, you know, don't take a photo, it's bad luck, and that the doll is still haunted at the museum there down in the Keys, I don't believe in this idea that it was some other spirit that inhabited the doll and it was a haunted doll from the beginning. Yeah, I believe it was Gene and this and the PK telekinesis activity. I think if it's haunted now, that it is Gene that is actually who's connected to the doll. He's the spirit connected to the doll now, and those hauntings are actually Gene.
Like a conduit. Wow, and you mentioned PK, and for the listeners, that's psychokinesis?
Correct, yeah.
And in this case, it would be telekinesis, where objects are being moved. Yeah, there's a lot of studies out there amongst different researchers trying to figure out what causes poltergeist-style activity. I've read reports that there's usually some kind of encounter with non-biological entities, be them quote-unquote extraterrestrial, like the alien, or other kind of supernatural, all the way up to, like you said, somebody's mental capabilities interacting within the world around them. When you found that the doll was really something that you found interesting to you, did anything particular inspire you to research related phenomenon?
Yeah, I mean, that's, I mean, I've kind of been involved in some way, shape, or form with that type of research for decades. You know, I had a pretty harrowing shadow person experience when I was a child, when I was about 8 years old. You know, and I didn't understand at the time that it was a shadow person type of manifestation or anything like that, because I was so young. You know, but woke up in the middle of the night, there's this tall, dark figure standing in the corner of my room. You know, and I just think that it's an intruder. Somebody's broken into the house.
Right.
They're gonna rob the place. You know, I'm even like, is it gonna kill me?
Of course.
That's what you think at that age. You know, I'd seen enough television and enough movies at the time that I figured I'd had enough time to gasp, like, and then that was it.
Right.
I'd be a goner. Fortunately, I'm still allowed to tell the tale, which is great. But it did get physical with me. So, you know, this thing approached my bed and I'm trying to scream. My mouth opens up. Nothing's coming out. You know, just I'm too terrified. And it leans over my bed. I'm staring into this blank black face. There's nothing there. No eyes, no nose, no mouth. Nothing at all. And then it did something really unusual. It grabbed me by the wrists, crossed my arms across my body, and then it ran off down the hall, of all places, into a closet. By that point, I found my voice, found my legs, ran off screaming to my parents' bedroom, you know, about what had happened. And, you know, I have nice, kind parents who are trying to console me, calm me down, trying to tell me I'd just had a bad dream. But I'd been awake for this whole incident. Now, I would never call that house a haunted house. This was really just like a one-off incident. We had lived there for 10 years before we moved when I was 13. Now, when I moved, the former house was in Massachusetts. We moved to Ohio, and the new house had some other activity going on inside. And again, it was shadow type activity, but different than that first incident. Because this thing that I was seeing, you know, I'm unpacking boxes, putting things away, and I kept seeing something standing in my doorway to my bedroom. And I turn and look, and it would, you know, run off toward my parents' bedroom. And this was, again, it was kind of shadowy in nature. It was more translucent, very, very fast. But it would not get interactive like that first one. So this is something different. I saw this several times over the course of the first first few days that we were there before I decided to ask my mom about it.
How old were you, Mike?
And I was just like, Mom, I was 13 at this time. The first time was 8. This time was 13. Yeah. And I was like, Mom, I keep seeing this. And maybe she thought I was a little more mature at that age. I don't know how mature you can consider a 13-year-old, but, you know, at least more than an 8-year-old, right? And so she told me that, yes, she had seen the same thing, which was great for me. So it's affirmation that, okay, I'm not crazy. Mom is seeing this thing too. But another great thing about it was she didn't seem very alarmed about it. Like, she was just very accepting that, yeah, I've seen this too. Like, okay, so Mom's not worried about it. Then I shouldn't be worried about it either. So I decided to get playful with the thing. I started calling him Tom, as in like peeping Tom. And so anytime I'd see him in the door, I'd be like, hi, Tom. And off he'd go. And that activity lasted for about 3 or 4 months. And then it just kind of subsided. So I chalked it up to something that was there at the house, was curious about the new family moving in, deemed that we were okay. And, you know, it went about its business. So those were really the first, you know, couple of incidents that, you know, really piqued my interest about this type of phenomenon.
Do you find that there's specific locations or environments that seem to tend towards these kinds of manifestations?
Well, I mean, the manifestations can happen really in any environment. But we look for patterns. That second shadow incident, it was a newer house. We had moved into a house that was no more than about 10 years old at that time. The first house was a little bit older. And so it kind of makes you wonder, okay, what was the catalyst here? Now, we do tend to see that, older, more historic locations seem to be more prevalent toward that type of activity. I think a lot of it has to do with the land itself. We, definitely noted hotspot areas around the world that are more prone to supernatural activity. You know, like our triangle areas, like Bermuda Triangle, Alaska Triangle, these sorts of things, where we have, ley lines cross, which is really the telluric currents under the ground. Those tend to be more energetic, and you have, and not just paranormal supernatural activity. You have UFO activity, more cryptid sightings, missing people, missing airplanes, all kinds of, different strange phenomena will happen at these particular locations. So those seem to be more centralized, but this activity can still happen anywhere.
Yeah, because as far as I've been able to research, I think physicists say that we've got about 11 different dimensions. And typically when we start talking about anything above our three dimensions, so fourth dimensional, Salvador Dali did a painting of Christ crucified on a tesseract unfolded. And that's usually what I point out. You know, if we just take the idea of a tesseract, and you can look that up, anybody who's listening, then look up Salvador Dali's crucified Christ painting, and you could see what a tesseract unfolded in three-dimensional space would look like, because we can't comprehend it. We really cannot.
We can't. And yeah, a lot of the illustrations and drawings, even 3D renderings that you see of a Tesseract. And by the way, for the listeners, we're not talking about the Marvel Magic Cube, the glowing, the glowing cube that opens up portals. We're not talking about
Loki's after.
But those illustrations still seem to be very, very heavy handed because they're essentially taking a cube and almost putting like another cube on top of it. So you're taking a 3D object and putting another 3D object on top of it. It's not really what it's gonna look like. So I thought, because Interstellar, the movie Interstellar, I thought they did a decent job of trying to interpret that. Like he was inside the Tesseract and got to see like every moment of his daughter's bedroom, and they're all connected via strings. So kind of harkening back to the idea of string theory. And so, yeah, it's like this infinite, infinite connected moments. And that's what I get into with my book on Travels Through Time and Stacked Time Theories. I kind of, dissect the fourth dimension, which is time, and the other dimensions above that 5, 6, 7, 8, and how they would actually view our dimension of time. So I think, Christopher Nolan's idea of the Tesseract is a decent place to start from. Again, it probably does not look like that. And it's probably not really, if you were to find yourself inside one, how that would actually look. Yeah. But I thought he was heading down a decent path with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, from a Christian perspective, when somebody actually speaks about God, he's not like some kind of cosmic sauce that's combining all of the ingredients together on a big panentheistic hamburger. He's this entity that could see all things at all times, etc. And that means somebody in a state where they're outside of time, they would be observing every moment of time when they put their will to it. And that's what it seems like some of these entities can do, is when they're not wherever they are,
right,
and they decide to interact within our realm, it seems like their intellect is able to put them where they correct need to be or want to be.
Yeah, they are, many of these are above our dimension of time, so they can move in and about. And that's
like
another reason why when we look at them, we get a glimpse of them. We're not seeing them in their entirety. We are only getting, that's why they look like shadows. Some of them might look like some sort of light being. You hear about people seeing like some sort
that's
of
why they look like shadow
person in this sort of, a lot of different variations of what people are actually seeing. And that's because, we don't have the proper geometry to be able to see it. I mean, for one, or even the proper physiology, for one, our eyes only see into a very narrow range. Audibly, we only hear, certain wavelengths and what have you. But you just take this, a great example of, flatland. So basically it's like a two-dimensional world.
Yeah. Flatland is a great experience. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Two-dimensional world. So everything is just completely flat. Well, somebody in flatland, they would not be able to see a three-dimensional object the way that we see it, because we are, we're above three-dimensional space. We're in the fourth dimension of time. But somebody in flatland, when they would see a three-dimensional object, to take like a sphere, pass into their world, all they would see is like this circle start to open up on the ground as the sphere would pass through it. And then as it reaches the apex, and it would be, full circle, and then it would shrink back down to that smaller circle as it passed through. They would have no idea that there was something much bigger involved than that circle that they were seeing.
Yeah, as far as flatlanders are concerned, they would have no concept at all of potential color, etc., of the object as it passes through. There's a whole lot of different ideas with the piece of paper experiment showing what two dimensionals is. And you're absolutely right. The human brain is designed to work within this three-dimensional space, to observe things here, to listen to things here, touch, taste, etc. However, It's clear and obvious that other things outside of what we perceive exist. You have cats staring off into the right. Babies, infants looking into corners, talking to people that aren't there. These are more than just environments where there's heavy electrical activity. You know, an older house, the wiring is kind of not what we do today. And those typically have a whole lot more activity going on, but it's closer to PK than it is to hauntings. But if you were to think about any particular haunted place, would you associate it more with things in a different dimension, as in scientific mind, or a different dimension as in spiritual?
It depends on the location of the haunting that's going on. I mean, some of these are going to be human spirits. Some of them are going to be interdimensional beings, sure. Some of these are going to be time slips, where we're getting a glimpse of another moment in time. So they're neither a human spirit that is stuck there. They're not an interdimensional being either. We are actually seeing another moment in time play out. Some of these are also extraterrestrials. So, you know, there's a whole variety of things that right. they could be. And just, this is where, you know, it takes investigative work to, you know, try to figure out what exactly is going on at a specific location.
There's all sorts of memes. And one of the most recent memes that I seen was, These things these ghosts were seeing, why are they always dressed back to the Victorian era? Why don't they wear anything? Why don't we see ghosts in loincloths, basically?
Right. And I think it's an inaccurate generalization because of a lot of films and television shows and things like that of that nature. I think it's, you know, almost like, you know, we enjoy, especially this time of year, A Christmas Carol. And so that's during that era. And so, you know, we see those type of ghosts. So that's our idea and our vision of what a classic, you know, ghost looks like. Right. And I think that's an unfair characterization because people do actually see ghosts and apparitions of a variety of different types of people in all different eras. You know, people do see, you know, Native American spirits. You know, they do see them here. Okay. That happens. They see soldiers from different eras, whether it's Revolution, whether it's Civil War. There are World War II spirits that are seen. You know, so it's all different eras that are actually experienced. I think there's just this, what's the word that I'm looking for? Stereotype when it comes to ghosts that we're going to stick them in that era. And I think it goes back to Dickens, and he was very, very influential in our idea of what a ghost and a spirit looks like.
Or if we were even think of somebody like, I don't know, H.P. Lovecraft comes to mind, and he writes in his Call of Cthulhu that basically the human mind cannot correlate all of the contents that it experiences.
Oh, sure.
It has no ability to, you know, to follow like Plato's ideas, you know, dog, house, tree are ideal images floating around in some kind of ether. And we have to pull down that image and overlay it with the thing we're looking at and go, okay, that chihuahua is dog, or this tree. Okay. That's an evergreen tree. That's an oak tree. But idea of tree is being pulled down from somewhere. But the human mind, when it's experiencing these other things, it cannot correlate its contents. It can't figure out. It has no file to pull from. And I think that's why we see what we see.
And I agree with that to an extent.
Yeah.
In one sense, he's kind of describing the holographic universe in his day and age. We try to make sense of what we see and what we experience. And sometimes we are only getting a vague glimpse of it, kind of like what we were talking about before. And so, you know, we try to, you know, okay, did we just see a ghost or a spirit? Or I don't even understand what it is that I saw, you know, with some sort of, you know, shadow wisp that just darted across, or a manifestation of, we saw black smoke morph into the apparition of a little girl. You know, what in the world was that? Mm-hmm. You know, so there's a lot of strange right. things that we see over time.
The holograph theory is really an interesting one to me because at the heart of the matter, everything is, after all, you know, atoms. And I do believe the base of an atom is a photon. So technically, everything is light. You've written about the holographic universe. Can you talk about that a little bit?
A little bit, yeah. Well, and here's the thing. I think there are some principles there that are correct. That in some sense, that I mean, it's an artificial universe. You know, I do believe in the simulation theory. Not necessarily that it's a computer simulation, right. But you know, something that's more organic or biological in nature. Mm-hmm. I think it's a type of technology that we just can't comprehend yet. The idea of, you know, projecting into this universe, I believe that the consciousness is being projected into this world, especially with time all being concurrent. Every moment is existent as a whole. If you believe in reincarnation and what have you, well, your consciousness is being projected into each of those moments that you're actually existing in this universe. The one problem that I have with the holographic principle is, you know, when we look at, you know, to call it a hologram, I think we need to find a different term. I think it's similar in technology, but it's not exactly the same, because our holograms that we have today, the thing is, we can't touch a hologram.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
You know, it's our not head a would pass right through. Right. It's not material. But yet what we are experiencing here in this world is we are able to touch all these objects. So it's not quite a hologram in our traditional sense that that we think of or that we have defined as a hologram. It has different principles to it. So I think there's some similarities to it, but still a little different.
Your book travels through time. One of the things that I enjoyed most was your take on time, your stacked time theory. And I find it interesting because I've been, you know, personally, you know, there's string theory, et cetera, and there's all these different components that seem to try to interact with dimensional space and realms, be them supernatural, be them physical, et cetera, with their own rules, physics, et cetera. And I've operated off the idea that time seems to be like a pile of spaghetti. And I know it's kind of a crude way of saying it, where spaghetti noodles and sauce all interact with each other at any point. You know, there's contact between one noodle and another noodle and sauce, etc. But in your book, Stack Time, you take the idea that we're looking at time not as a solitary plane, like a sheet of paper, but as lots of stacked paper. And you can interact in a three-dimensional time space. And that was my takeaway.
So it's that idea. Okay, we've kind of already danced around it a little bit. And, you know, all time is concurrent; it all exists. So, and that's not, you know, people have suggested that before. I mean, it popped into my head one day about 20 years ago. It came in there independently, but when I started going down that rabbit hole of the nature of time, you know, I did stumble across, oh, okay, you know, Einstein had his idea of the block universe, but I'd already been toying around with this idea of, okay, well, time is concurrent. Take where you're sitting right now, and every moment that has happened, is happening, and will happen are all there right now. Each of those moments, like a photograph in this tall, tall, tall stack of photos that goes on endlessly. And every once in a while, we have, you know, there are two of those moments, because everything is, you know, frequency, resonance, vibration, it's energy. And two of those moments will resonate at the same frequency for just a moment, and we'll get a glimpse of another one. And so that would be something like we call a time slip. But that might be what some of these, what we might think is a ghost or an apparition or some sort of haunting. People have reported seeing an entire scene play out before them. And so it might not be this, you know, human spirit that's still lingering around. Although I do believe, you know, there are human spirits that are lingering around. They're just, you know, their consciousness is still there. They just are missing the three-dimensional body. But, you know, some of these are just a moment in time that's, and it's not playing back for them. It's not the whole, you know, stone tape theory where, you know, it kicks off and plays back a moment. It is actually seeing and interacting with another moment in time where you're looking, maybe it's back into the past, but the past, those people there are looking back at you. They're looking into the future.
Yeah, there's a novel by Dean Koontz, I do believe it was, who wrote about these guys. They had science discovery where they were able to open a window and observe the past. But I think they worked off of something more like a wormhole than a mere cause.
Yeah, there was that that movie Deja Vu with Denzel Washington, where it was kind of like that. Mm-hmm. They were looking through a window. It looked like a monitor on the wall, and they were able to see what was going on, and there was some interaction. Like what was it, the laser pointer that he shot through there, right. And there was an interaction there, and then he ended up actually going back. So kind of think of that. Now with that particular movie, it was still moving linearly, but at another moment. I forget what the time lapse was, but in this case with stack time, it's really kind of just pull two of those photos out of the stack and just kind of interlace them together so that they're meshed together for just a moment. And real time travel to me would be harnessing the ability to do that, because right now when it happens, when it occurs, it's really almost by accident. Everything's kind of syncing up perfectly for just a moment, whether it's a couple seconds or a minute or whatever it is. So real time travel to me would be able to be able to purposefully sync that up and be able to control it.
Yeah, we're not talking about flying backwards around the sun a few times.
No. yeah, not spinning the planet backwards like Superman, or jumping into a DeLorean and firing up the flux capacitor. No, it's not that.
And you wrote about one of my favorite scientists of all time, Nikolai Tesla. And you wrote about him, and I appreciate your kind descriptions. And mm-hmm. The fact that, I mean, there was a man who was out of time. Many have theorized that he was actually from the future and somehow walked through a time slip and got stuck. And then wherever he ended up, he adopted some woman to be his mother, etc. We're Clark Kent kind of situation here. I mean, you've got all sorts of fairy tale stories that could spawn from an individual who was clearly working with ideas. I mean, I can't remember if it was Tesla or not, but lightning itself being a plasma, and then other people going, well, plasma has intelligence.
Yeah, plasma is certainly interesting. We see, that play out with like earthquake lights.
Hey, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah. Is the energy of the earth creating this, or, are there beings that are almost, maybe they're coming back and warning us, hey, an earthquake's going to happen. We kind of really don't understand, because it doesn't happen with every earthquake. It happens with some. But then there are even, some of these occurrences that have been, chalked up to something religious in nature. That seems to be more of a plasma event. You see this bright light that seems almost angelic in nature or whatever. It gets chalked up to maybe the visage of Mary or whatever. But really it's almost like some sort of plasma or ball lightning event. So, what exactly is that? Is there a intelligent entity that's trying to communicate with us? Is there something about the area that is causing another dimension to leak through? We really still don't quite understand that. And as far as Tesla, I believe he was born in his time. Mm-hmm.
He was certainly connected.
Yeah, he was certainly connected to other ideas of our existence. When he was a younger man, he had played back when he was in Serbia. He had played around with astral projection. He definitely knew a lot about the way the pyramids worked and how they were harnessing the earth energy. And that's essentially what he was trying to do with the Wardenclyffe Tower. But I talk in the book about the collective unconscious. I talk about the Akashic records. I call it eternal knowledge, that you're able to tap into that universal knowledge that is available to us. And again, remember, if all time is concurrent, past, present, future, everything there from our universe is a whole. That means all the information of it is there and available to us. You know, take like a computer program. You might only be within part of that program. If you're like in a, let's say a flight simulator, you know, you might be flying over a specific town in the flight simulator, but all the other information, all the other data, all the other locations and runways and objects in the sky, all that information is still available there within the flight simulator program. So same thing with our universe. All the information of the universe is right here, right now, and we can tap into it and get that information. I think he was very, very in tune with the eternal knowledge that is floating out there. And sometimes, and he had the mind to be able to comprehend it, he would, you know, essentially download that, whether it was in his sleep or in a meditation or when he's going through some sort of thought experiment or whatever, he was able to download that into his mind. He could grasp the concept of it and then he'd start running with it. And because it was something that was so far ahead of that time, people would laugh at him. But we have a lot of that technology today that he was talking about over 100 years ago.
Yes, in fact, my phone is currently sitting on a charger that I don't have to plug my phone into. And that's wireless technology. That's wireless charging.
That's wireless technology right there. Yeah, we have wireless internet. We have, you know, he basically invented the first drone.
Yes.
With his teleautomaton. And then, you know, he started talking about how, you know, he could, you know, have that teleautomaton, which is basically like a little boat, a little submarine, that it could make decisions on its own. It would know where to go, find its own targets. And he's talking about artificial intelligence. And they took that even a step further and said, I could build a teleautomaton of myself that would look and act and respond just like me. So he's talking about, you know, robots and artificial intelligence, you know, well over 100 years before people even had that idea and concept. Now, for him, you know, he's thinking the type of technology it would take to build it. He's thinking, you know, gears, wheels, radio waves, that sort of stuff. You know, he didn't know about the silicon microchip at that time. That was invented like 16 years after he had died. So this kind of goes back to my when I talk about the simulated universe, that we have an idea of how that might function, but we really don't understand the technology behind it. So with Tesla, I think he definitely understood the functionality of artificial intelligence and drones and robots and that sort of thing. He had that in his mind. I don't quite think he knew how exactly it would all develop.
Some real life today, I utilize ChatGPT for when it comes to podcasting. And that is something that is interesting because I grew up watching Star Trek, and I'm sure you did too.
Mm-hmm.
They had a computer that can talk back. It can answer questions that you asked it, seemingly with its own, you know, whatever data it contained, and it could process that information and give you an answer based upon its resources, which is, you know, artificial intelligence after all.
Oh yeah.
Through all of that, you know, portable phones, you know, the idea that Tesla even spoke about being able to communicate with, honestly, cell phone technology. Dreams of science fiction become reality because we put our minds to it, not because it just happens.
Yes. Yeah, that's why it drives me nuts when people, you know, laugh at some of the ideas. Oh, that's science fiction. That's just, you know, that's just a movie. It's just a story. It's like, yeah, but that's where a lot of our ideas come from. And we end up making that a reality. Might be 10 years down the road.
Yeah, it's the sandbox we're playing in.
Yeah, exactly.
We construct dreams into physical realities. And you're right, with, you know, the idea of an Akashic record or a cosmic consciousness, if you will. With time, being able to talk to ideas in the future and the past to bring it into now as imagination seems to be one of the most powerful creative tools at our disposal. And I bring that up because there are individuals who use things like automatic writing. Opinsky comes to mind. Opinsky was the guy, he was a student of Berdjieff, and he took the Enneagram and turned it into what we understand it today with a psychology kind of test, you know, the Briggs-Young or something. And he had done that through the the powers of automatic writing. He was tapped into something other. And that's what I find peculiar, because as we've been talking about ideas from psychic kinesis all the way up to possible things from another time interacting in our world, it still leaves us with the question, why? Why are these things interacting with us? To what ends?
Right. There's the big question. The meaning to life, the universe, and everything, which we know 42. Is 42. That's right. Yeah. It's going to be simplistic. I don't know if we're as humans going to ever know like the true why of the universe. Why are we playing this out again and again and again? There is a grand scheme to it. I think it's a little bit beyond us, at least at this point. So I break it down to our single, well, I can't say single experience because we're here multiple times, but at least our individual experience in this particular lifetime. And I break it down to just that. And that is, a couple things. You know, we're here to, love each other and help each other out, mm-hmm. Throughout our lives. The people that are around us, our loved ones, our friends, and so forth, and other, people by extension, in throughout the world. And to, the knowledge that we gain, pass it on. Because humanity seems to be caught in this vicious cycle of repeating the same mistakes again and again and again. So, I've been acquiring all of this knowledge, and through my books and videos and television shows that have appeared on, I'm trying to pass that knowledge on to the next generation, because this body is not going to be here forever.
Right.
So, I can't make the next generation pick up the mantle, but hopefully they do and continue forward, so that we don't keep repeating some of these other mistakes and that knowledge is built off of as humanity continues to go.
Mike, you've got a whole heap of things that you've got planned for the summer and the fall. Can you go ahead and tell us where we can find you, what things we can do with you, etc.?
Yeah, absolutely. By the time this goes out, it'll really be a last call for our Stargates of Ancient Egypt tour that is in April. It's April 16th to the 28th. You can find the links to that on my website. You can find my entire event schedule out there. So I have a number of different events that I'm going to be a part of this year. ParapsyCon here in Ohio. That's at the Ohio State Reformatory. We've got the Michigan Paracon that is coming up, Hauntlanta, down in Atlanta. Trying to think of what other ones I have off the top of my head. Actually, it's entirely a year away. I just inked the contract for the Missouri Paracon out in Kansas City. That's next February and March. Another tour that I'm working on, which may be accessible by the time this airs, is a couple of tours out in Ireland in late July, early August. So they are two individual weeks. So I'll be out there for a little more than 2 weeks. And, each of those tours will be hitting a little bit of a different part of Ireland. So all that will be linked right there on my website. So when that is available, and fingers crossed it is by the time this airs, because we need to get people registering, yeah. We're talking July. It should be available there on my website by then.
Fantastic. Yeah. And then this interview, we focused on your travels through Time Book. We also spoke a little bit about shadow people in the interview, and that one, people can read more about it in A Walk in the Shadows. And then you've done Campfire Tales. What was that one about, real quick?
Campfire Tales Midwest. Yeah, it's a collection of short stories, fun ghost stories that you would tell sitting by the campfire, but based on real history and legends. And so that was a fun book to work on.
And then the last thing, Mike, real quick before I let you go, is do you have another book in the works? Or are we still touring for Travels Through Time?
Oh, yeah. I always have another book in the works. So Travels Through Time is the first in the Connecting the Universe series. So I'm working on the second one for that. I'm trying to have that one out by later this year. We'll see how that process goes. I do have a lot of things on my plate, but I'm always working on new works there. So, yeah, if you sign up for my newsletter, which you can do it at MikeRicksecker.com, actually what it'll do is you'll click on the sign up for the newsletter. It's going to take you to Connected Universe Portal, and you sign up for the newsletter there. And then you'll keep up to date on everything that I have going on between the events, tours, television appearances, and all of those sorts of things.
And then you went ahead and just put all your chips on the table, threw your cards down, and said, I'm all in, and you've started a membership program. And
yeah, absolutely. That's what the Connected Universe Portal is. It's a community and membership area where we have weekly classes. There's all kinds of courses and what else do I have? All kinds of videos. Like I have my Mike's Morning Mug video, which is, we're sitting down chatting over a particular topic. I do that live once per month now.
We just did one last night.
Did.
That was great. And it's a really good opportunity for your listeners, audience, and fans to be able to participate nearly on a one-on-one opportunity to just discuss things. Really awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it gives members some personal time with me. I mean, we do that a little bit with the Connecting the Universe classes on Wednesday evening, but that's in, that's in a broader setting, basically a live stream. We have an after show for that. So members to the portal get in on the after show part of that for, we got about 20 minutes following the episode and have some more of that, personal, almost one-on-one time together. But what's great about the Morning Mug interaction is, like with Connecting the Universe, those interactions are questions and comments and things like that that are thrown down into a chat room, where with the live Morning Mug, we're on video together. It's really like we're sitting down having a nice conversation together.
Absolutely. Let me ask one final question, and I'm going to get you to go way back into your mind here. Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Can you find or remember anything that you investigated, paranormal, etc., any stories from your investigative journalism past that you would go, that haunting, that thing was diabolical?
I've been on a number of different cases, and sometimes you end up with, here's the thing. Just because it is something that is diabolical or nefarious in nature doesn't immediately mean that it's demonic. It could just be, you have human spirits. The person was a jerk in life, and they are a jerk in the afterlife too. So you do end up with those. There was one case that I was on that was actually deemed demonic. It was by Carl Johnson, who's been in the field for over 50 years. He is a quote unquote demonologist by trade, but he has dealt with these types of nefarious cases for a long time. And I'll preface this in that he does not lightly define something as demonic. Good friends with him, I've had him on my show several times. And the last time I had him on my show a couple years ago, I had asked him, hey, Carl, you've been doing this for 50 some odd years. You know, what was the last case that you were on that you would actually deem demonic? And he's like, you know, Mike, actually, the last one that I would actually say was demonic was that one that you and I were on in Edmond, Oklahoma, back in 2010. So we just had this interview like maybe 2 years ago. So it had been like 11 years between the time that, you know, he had actually considered something demonic. So it's not something he takes lightly. And so it was that particular case. And with this one, it was a, well, the family had been experiencing things in the house for 20 years and nobody was talking to each other about it until things were, and things would kind of ebb and flow. Like the son before he, when he was like a teenager before, you know, years before he moved out, he described like a wrestling match that took place in his room. They would see it, but unseen entities, you know, it was like, things were falling and crashing and he could hear a struggle going on, but he couldn't see anything. They, at other times they would see shadow figures and it's all kinds of different things going on throughout the house. But, when we were brought in was the, adult daughter, Taliesin, had been seeing this red-eyed shadow entity in her closet. And it would terrorize her, it would terrorize the cat. Others were seeing the shadow figure move about, sometimes with the red eyes, sometimes without. So we were brought in to this case, and we worked with them for several months, many investigations there. This was, they ended up filming it for The Haunted on Animal Planet, because there was a cat that was involved. So, you know, we're gonna go from the cat's perspective that they interact with this stuff. Yeah, I know. It was interesting. The way they did it was actually an interesting show. But that, we brought Carl in, and we're doing a cleansing of the house. And we're going from room to room. He's doing a blessing and this sort of thing. We had the family wait outside while we were doing this. And Taliesin had come into the house to use the restroom in the master bedroom. And we end up finding her in there talking at something unseen.
And how old was Taliesin at the time?
She was early 20s. And she was like 23, 24.
We're not talking about a toddler. We're talking about a full adult.
No, we're not talking about a little kid. We're talking about an adult.
Talking to something. Okay.
Talking to something. Yes. She's asking, you know, why are you here? Why are you terrorizing me? Why are you terrorizing my family? Those sorts, sorts of questions. And so so Carl comes in. He starts to do a blessing. He decides to do a blessing over her. And when he does, she suddenly doubles over in pain. You hear an audible like that. Yeah. And she doubles over and falls to the floor. So we get her back up, get her onto the bed there in the master bedroom. She's okay. When I listened back to my audio later on, because I had an audio recorder going, right at that moment, you heard something say, die. And then, you know, Taliesin get punched in the gut. Ugh. So it was like, oh, okay, something vicious was going on there. This was definitely directed at her. So as, you know, we're getting her back up, she's okay. All kinds of other crazy things started happening that they didn't show in the show. In fact, you know, the whole way that they edited that, they used that die clip earlier on in the show to be like the reason why, you know, we were doing the cleansing of the house. And it's like, no, that actually happened during the cleansing.
Fair enough.
But I get it.
We see plenty of TV shows
right,
do that.
Of course. They needed something to say, this is why we're doing the cleansing. But there was plenty of other material they could have used. But in any case, so the as that's going on, we're making sure she's okay. But a tri-field meter set up in her bedroom that was right there by the closet that, you know, she kept seeing this thing at. That starts going off like crazy. And then the back door to the master bedroom that leads outside blows open. And we close it, and it blows open again. Close it again. Make sure the thing's dead bolted. All that happened like three times. So Carl's doing like a blessing over the door and all that. So it's pretty crazy. So continuing the blessing of the house, and we push the energy outside into the backyard. So we're back there. Carl's continuing on with his blessing. The wind really, really kicks up in that backyard. And there were two cats that were circling us as we're back there in the backyard. Carl's doing his thing. It was just absolutely bizarre with the wind and the cats and all of this. Finally, Carl finishes whatever he was reciting, some sort of a prayer or what have you. Finishes, he drops to a knee, the wind stops. And it's like, it's done. He says, all right, it's gone. It's all done. And so we're like, okay, get Carl back on his feet. He's okay. Go over to the side yard where the family had been hanging out, and we're letting them know, we're finished up. Everything's good to go. And one of us remarked, wow, that was some wind that had really kicked up. And Oz, who is the father, he's like,
yes.
What wind? They're just over there in the side yard. And it's not a very big yard. They're just over there in the side yard. They didn't experience any of that wind at all that we had experienced. So, that would be the most diabolical case. But, that cleansing worked because we've been in touch on and off over the years, and they haven't had any recurring problems.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, well, thank you, Brandon.
Thank you for listening. This is a free podcast based upon the value for value model. If you find value in this or any episode, you can return that value by liking the show, subscribing to this channel, leaving a review, or sharing with a friend on your social media accounts. You can also donate on my website. Thank you again. This is BT for Truth and Shadow Podcast. You are the light in the darkness.